Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. And today I am so excited to introduce this guest. We've been trying to get him on the show for a while. I've listened to all of his podcasts and I just can't wait. This call is probably going to take way more than the hour I've got planned, so we may have to invite him back. But it gives me great pleasure to welcome on the show Dr. Phil Maffetone.
Hi, Simon. So nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, Phil. I do appreciate that. So you're probably speaking to me from sunny Florida right now, are you? Or are you expecting a tropical storm sometime soon?
It's sunny right now, and I don't pay attention to the media. I sort of live in my mind off the grid, so I'm not expecting any bad weather for a while.
But North Carolina's not too far away from Florida, is it? It must be bordering you there in the north. You didn't get that storm that came via there then in the last couple of days?
No, it's really been sunny. It actually has been relatively dry for September, and so I've just moved here, so I'm getting familiar with the weather patterns, which I've always been interested in my life, because weather has a big impact on our health and fitness. And so I've always been interested in following the weather. But right now it's a beautiful day here.
Well, and of course, when it's sunny, everybody's happy, aren't they? So that has to have an impact on our health and fitness too. So Phil, I said privately before we started that I had a confession to make to you. So firstly, I have one of your very first books, I think. It's called Everyone's an Athlete. And I've been involved in the triathlon scene now for about just over 30 years. I started back in 1986. So Mark Allen was still getting his ass kicked in Kona. And then he had that amazing race in 1989 where he suddenly took over the mantle from Dave Scott. But I remember reading some work by you. It was probably in a triathlete magazine where the article was talking about how Mark had started working with you and he'd started running easier. And, you know, when you first put a heart rate monitor on him and tried to get him to run at the math heart rate of 180 minus his age, he was 2 minutes per mile slower than he'd run in Kona to win that race. And I remember looking at it and thinking, well, this is hogwash. How can this possibly help? You know, going easy. Surely you've got to train at race speed and hammer yourself all the time. And that was me then. And I sort of pushed that methodology to one side while I continued down my merry way of getting injured every year and following convention. And of course, now I'm a little older, hopefully a little wiser, and I've been reading all this stuff and I realized that I should have listened perhaps back in the 1990s. So I apologize in advance for my ignorance back then. So.
Well, we learn that way, and I've learned that way. I've made plenty of mistakes, and when we learn from that, you know, we come out on the other side. We break through, and we are healthier people and more fit people. And from an athletic standpoint, we perform better. And what's difficult for me, and I had this exact conversation with Mark Allen when we did a podcast a couple of years ago with Tawny, you know, why don't young triathletes want to hear from Mark, for example, about what he went through? What were the problems that he had to figure out? And why can't he just pass that information on? And, you know, we don't have answers other than it's a social thing. You know, it's a generational thing. We have issues with the different generations, and certainly when I was growing up, we didn't trust anybody over the age of 30 because, you know, we were teenagers and we were hippies and we didn't trust, politicians and so, but still I had some people I knew well who were older people. They were people in their 50s and 60s, and I really respected them. And I'm not sure we're seeing a lot of that in triathlon anymore. We're seeing, I got to figure out what to do by myself, or I'm going to train like my friends because this is a cool thing. This is a great sport, and they're doing it, and I'm going to do it. And of course, we'll have to train fast to run fast and all that kind of nonsense. And it's interesting to see that in action. And it was even more interesting for Mark and I to have that discussion. You know, why aren't people interested in taking advice from not just one of the greatest triathletes ever, but one of the greatest athletes ever when you think about what he really did?
Well, I can remember then, subsequent to you reading about his involvement with you, was then reading about the time, you know, Paul and Eubie Fraser used to use this thing about saying that if you wanted to have a great career, you have to rest and you have to take time away and you need to turn your back on the sport for several months afterwards. And Mark Allen did just that, didn't he? He didn't really do much formal training. I'm sure he kept fit and he went surfing and rode his cruiser along the beach there. But he took a great deal of time off after Hawaii every year and came back in January. And then he went with Brandt and he did all this shame and stuff. And I'm thinking, how can you still be at the top when you're not training all the time? Everybody else is doing it this way. And yet here's this one guy who just does it this way. He takes a couple of weeks off before his major competition. He takes 2 or 3 months off at the end of every year. He's doing it totally different and still not connecting the fact that he was dominating the world in triathlon at that time. And surely there was something to this, and dismissing it as more hogwash that was, that he was just a freak of nature.
Yeah. This was something I learned when I was in practice from the beginning. You know, I started practice in 1977. I was in the northern suburbs of New York City. The running boom was exploding. And I was seeing all these runners, and I was seeing beginner runners, good amateur runners, professional runners. And one thing they had in common was they were all tired. They never took time off, because taking time off was considered, you know, it was considered being a wimp. You don't take time off. You know, we're athletes. We train. You know, these runners in New York City, they're running down the street and they come to a traffic light and everybody's standing there waiting. They can't stop running. So they run around in circles until the light turns green and they could cross the street. It's an obsession with training. And I always had the athletes I worked with take time off. The off season, it's called the off season for a reason. You need to take time off. Time off before an event so that your recovery, your body's recovery mechanism can catch up, and that's something that actually makes you stronger. That was a hard sell for many athletes. And one thing about Mark, like some of the athletes I've worked with, is Mark was fairly intelligent. Mark had been to college. I think he has a degree in biology. And he would always want to know why, you know, what happens during the taper, you know, why 2 weeks of taper before Ironman, and understanding how the mechanisms work, I think, is a big part of implementing it. Some people are perfectly fine saying, "Hey, tell me what to do and I'll do it." And I've had success with that. But for the most part, the athletes I've worked with who have been most successful understand the process.
Yeah, I, as a coach, I do find it difficult sometimes when athletes don't want to rest. You know, I have and hear about an athlete at the moment who did an Ironman 2 weeks ago, less than 2 weeks ago, he's already preparing to do a 10-mile run, ready to start his training for next year. And just trying to encourage him that, you know, the best way to get ready for next year is to spend a bit of time resting first rather than going straight back into training.
Yeah, recovery is just not in the equation for people. And my you know, back in I think it was 1980, I came up with this training equation. And I said, just follow the training equation. Training equals your workout plus your recovery. Recovery is rest. And so you need to sleep enough hours, you know, 7 to 9 hours, but you need to sleep well. And if you're not recovering, then you need to either change your lifestyle so that you do recover, or you need to reduce your workout, or you need to do some combination of both. Otherwise, your training quality goes down.
I think Chrissy Wellington, I was at a presentation with her a few years ago, and somebody in the Q&A said to her, how many hours of training did you do? Because that's what everybody's interested in. How many hours of training did you do to be world champion? And Chrissy just said, 168, at which everybody just sat there aghast, like, what? And then they were trying to work it out. And somebody said, but that's all the number of hours there are in the week. And she said, yes, because every hour of the week had some impact on my performance, whether it was resting, whether it was nutrition, whether it was meditating, whether it was strength and conditioning, every hour. So effectively, each of those hours was related to training in some way.
Yeah.
Great
answer. And it's obviously true. You know, your brain is nonstop. Your brain doesn't take a break. And even when we're sleeping, there's a lot going on up there. And we need to make sure that our brain is working well. We need to make sure our entire bodies, you know, just you mentioned the brain to athletes, and they say, "What? Why are you talking about the brain? I'm an athlete. My body needs to be trained," and, you know, blah blah blah. Well, it all begins in the brain.
Oh, that's interesting. That may be another subject we need to talk about altogether, Phil. But hey, you talked about when you were in New York, when you were working with these guys and you were giving them that formula of training equals work plus rest. Let's go right back to that time then. And when you developed the Maffetone method, and particularly this 180 minus age. So how did you come up with that score in the first place? And I know a lot of people still put a great deal of stock in the 220 minus age formula, and they're probably thinking, well, this is just another formula that another guy's come up with to promote his own methodology over this one. So how did you come up with yours, and why is that better than 220 minus age?
Right. The 220 formula has never been, it's been so vague. If you just go out and train and not even think about it, there's a good chance that you'll fit into the 220 formula the way it's described, because it's such a wide spectrum of possible heart rates and paces and so forth. So what I did in the beginning, even before I became a coach, and this is how I became a coach, my goal was to help people be healthier so that they can perform better. And I would spend time, and this was before heart monitors even came out. I had what I call an archaic heart monitor that was used in the hospital for cardiac patients. It was a big bulky strap they wore, and it would beep to their heart rate. And if you look down at it, it would tell you what your heart rate was. And I used that, and I would see an athlete. I would do an examination. I would do a really good history. I want to know about, what things is this athlete doing in their life? What kind of stresses do they have? What kind of food do they eat? What are their performance goals? Their exercise goals? And then I would go to the track with them. And on the track, I would have them run at a very slow pace. And I'd have to run alongside and look at their heart rate. And I would evaluate their gait. Sometimes I'd go off into the infield and I would watch them from a distance. Sometimes I'd be behind them or watch from the front. I would analyze their gait and I would gradually have them run faster and faster. And their gait would be, generally, their gait would be better when they were running slower, not too slow. But once they're warmed up, their gait's pretty good. Now they're running a little bit faster. Their gait's maybe even a little bit better. And at some point, the gait begins to falter. Their gait becomes distorted very slightly. And I thought, well, that's the point we don't want to go to. We want to go to a heart rate that's just below that level. And so my evaluation, especially on the track and watching their gait change, my evaluation and my recommendation was then, okay, I want you to train at this particular heart rate. And I'm gonna, you know, I had several heart monitors and I would lend them a heart monitor to go train for a couple of days and say, well, you see how fast you're going at this heart rate and you feel what it's like to be at a heart rate of 145 or whatever. And, you know, after you bring the heart monitor back, you keep training that way and I'll see you in a couple of weeks and, you know, we'll go from there. And I did that for several years, actually. And I was lecturing somewhere to a large group of athletes. And I was explaining this process. You know, I wasn't trying to get more athletes to come to my clinic because at that point I had a waiting list. It was just too busy. And someone asked, how could we come up with that heart rate? And I was embarrassed to not have an answer. And afterwards, I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, this must be a mathematical issue. It can't be that complicated to figure out. There must be a formula that I can come up with based on what I do clinically in working with an athlete one-on-one. And sure enough, the 180 formula was born. And the 180 formula is not really a formula. It's a way to individualize the formula. It's a way for you to take your personal world of health and fitness and adjust it to your training needs. So it's not just you subtract your age from 180. It's that you subtract your age from 180 and you make some adjustments, which, you know, there's a whole article on this on my website. And, you know, if you're not as healthy, you take your age from 180 and then you subtract more. If you're, uninjured and you're performing well, then you can add, to that. So it was a way to, the 180 minus the age was a first step. And then the second step was to personalize that. How do we individualize training to my particular needs? And that was a very important thing for athletes. So that's where it came from. Around the same time, I started testing sugar burning and fat burning. And I noticed that that particular heart rate, which became at that time known as the MAF heart rate, corresponded to fat burning and sugar burning. And we could actually see in the laboratory where that 180 formula gets the, they were sort of one and the same. And even today I hear from people all the time who work in a lab and they say, you know, we find, you know, on these treadmill tests that athletes, the 180 formula and what we're seeing correspond quite well. And I've noticed that for years. So we don't, you know, we can never be perfect. There's no perfect heart rate for any one person, but we can get very close and safe and assure progress using the 180 formula. I always recommend going to a lab and having your test done. But if you're going to do that, you've got to do it on a regular basis. And that pretty much rules out going to a lab on a regular basis for most most athletes, because there's an expense factor. There's not always a place you can go that's close to home. So for an amateur athlete, especially, it's not a reasonable thing to consider. The 180 formula becomes quite reasonable.
Yeah, and I guess that, as you say, that this isn't a black and white thing. There's no sudden change in physiology when you, if like my 180 minus age is 126. So if I go above 126, I'm not suddenly going to turn into all glycogen burning. There's a range, isn't there? So there are gray areas in between. So I think I've heard you mention this and several other physiologists that whatever test you do today in a lab may be different tomorrow, depending on how well you've slept, how stressed you are, what you've eaten, what time of day it is, what the ambient, weather is like. All of those things are going to have how motivated you are. They're all going to have an impact on how hard you can go, on what sort of test data you're going to get on that day. So again, there's an element of fluidity around the whole of this.
Yeah, lifestyle and also our environment, you know, the weather, like we talked about earlier, there are many factors that influence us. So on any given day, things are going to be a little different, which is why training by effort, in particular heart rate, is so much better than training by pace and distance. You know, so I'm going to go for a 10-mile run, and I'm going to average 8-minute pace. Well, there's just no meaning there. There's no value to that approach. I'm sorry, but that's what most people do. And it's really a reason why performances around the world are diminishing and injury rates are rising. So instead, we need to monitor effort, because our effort is, you know, if we look at the biofeedback component, the brain responds to the environment. The brain responds to all the stresses we're under. You know, if we had a bad day at work, if we have, you know, too much alcohol the night before on Sunday morning, we're going to be a little different. So our heart rate will respond to that by being higher, which will mean we have to slow down a little bit.
Well, I actually was very aware of this last year. I was lucky enough to race in Hawaii for the Ironman, and just before going there, I was able to get into the environment chamber at the university here in Leeds. And my first session, which was about a month before I went out, was supposed to be an hour and a half, and the Mark, who had set it all up for me, set the climactic conditions up to mimic what I'd experienced in Hawaii. And he said, I'm just going to plug you into this thermometer here, and I'm going to have a heart rate monitor on you, and I'm going to measure your details every 5 or 10 minutes. And that we have an ethical limit of core temperature that we don't want you to go above. So this will be the limit. And if I ask you to slow down, please do that. So I set off riding, and I was trying to replicate what I knew that would be the bike effort for the first 20, 30 minutes around Kona. And in that temperature, I was up above, I think I was pedaling at 200 watts, which was my average that I'd estimated I could hold for most of the day and run off. And within 30 minutes, my core temperature had reached its limit. And in order to stop it going above that, I had to pedal at 120 to 130 watts for the next hour. And my core temperature didn't come down, and neither did my heart rate. So all I was doing was stopping it going any higher. And that to me was an example of thermal load and how listening to your heart rate meant that you had to slow down. Now, if I'd been monitoring my watts, I would have got too hot. I would have been exhausted. And if that had been in the race day, I'd have been toast before I even got back to town.
Yeah, and that's typically what happens, is people get, regardless of what happens in the water, they're in the transition and they zoom off on the bike like it's a sprint, and they do the same thing on the run, and not only do you start using up your glycogen stores, which in an Ironman race is something it's like your retirement fund. You don't want to touch that. And the idea of getting out of T1 or T2 slower is, man, trying to convince an athlete of that is really, really hard. Of course, you know, what I found is that the athletes who are injured or who have burned out are more likely to accept the crazy things you tell them, because they've realized that all the different things they've done have only made them worse. So, as a little interesting aside, I learned long ago back with Mark. I think it was actually before his first win. He had the capability of winning two races before his first win, and he had he had mechanical problems. But I had already learned from Mark and some other athletes that in an Ironman event, the bike ride should be at that MAF heart rate, that MAF training heart rate. And then you get off the bike and you start your run and you really haven't tapped into your glycogen. You're feeling good. It's been a long day already, but you're still feeling good. And that's how people like Mark have run, you know, a 240. He was actually, I think, 238, because back then they counted the transition in the marathon. But, you know, that's how these athletes, and Paula the same way, were able to run these incredible marathon times because their bike was relatively slow. Their bike was at an MAF heart, it was a sub-max heart rate.
So I guess if I'm reading that right, then anybody who's preparing for a long-distance triathlon like that should be, rather than trying to boost their functional threshold power, which is, you know, all the high-end work that they do, what we should really be doing is seeking to be able to go as fast as possible at this MAF heart rate. And that's a lot of sub-maximal, easy riding below the MAF, you know, at the MAF heart rate. Yeah, and below.
Yeah, that's the key. Can you go, and this is what endurance is all about. Can you go faster at a sub-max heart rate that you're using to monitor your training? And in this case, we're talking about the MAF heart rate, which is a sub-max heart rate. This is a sub-max sport. We are so far from VO2 max in a race that, you know, especially in an Ironman or 70.3, we're 70-75% of our VO2 max. So, you know, we're sub-max. What is all this training for max, as if we're doing a sprint? So yes, as you train at that MAF heart rate, this is the key. As you train at that sub-max heart rate, which in the beginning most people complain is so slow that I could hear them curse me out from, you know, miles and miles away.
You can probably hear them from England as well, Phil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. I've learned all kinds of languages. but what happens is the human body is, it's resilient. And if you train the human body, it gets better. There's no genetics involved. You get better because that's the human physiology. That's the bodies that we're born with. And so training at this MAF heart rate, this submax heart rate, will allow you to get faster at the same heart rate over time. And so if you're training for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months, and you're going to go to Kona, or you're going to do whatever race, you're now able to go a lot faster, and you're able to generate a lot more power at the same heart rate. What a deal. I mean, that's just a great deal.
So I get that, Phil, for the longer distances, so particularly Ironman or even running marathon, half Ironman. But I do still sense that there would be some resistance from athletes who are either doing even a sprint triathlon, I know is, you know, equivalent to running a half marathon, so it's an endurance event. But somebody who's running a 5K or a 10K, where they're going to be out there for 40, 50 minutes, maybe 20 to 25 minutes if they're doing their Saturday morning park run, is going to look at the intensity that they run at and see themselves finishing with their heart rate almost touching maximum, and unable to make that link between the training philosophy that you've just mentioned and following that for several months and running hard on race day. How can I possibly... I understand the specifics of training. How can I possibly go faster if I don't train at my race pace for short events? What's the physiology that makes that work?
Yeah, the short answer is they can. The clinical answer is I saw it my whole career. I took a group of 229 runners, experienced runners who had a lot of 5K races under their belts. They trained for between 3 to 6 months at their MAF heart rate. They didn't do any speed work. They didn't race at all. Then they all did this 5K event, and 76% ran a personal best. And I've seen that in middle of the pack, back of the pack. I've seen it in professional athletes. You know, how does that happen? Well, it happens because you don't trash your health, number one. So you're now physically able to perform well because your body's balanced. Your muscles are balanced. Your hormones are balanced. Things work really well. Number two, you have trained your aerobic muscles. You know, a 5K, a 10K, you rely on 90% of your energy to be obtained from the aerobic system in a 10K. So, you know, why are we doing all the other stuff and not developing our aerobic system? So we develop our aerobic muscle fibers, which are the slow twitch muscle fibers. And those fibers actually feed the anaerobic muscle fibers, which quite often are right next door in the human body. Our fibers, our different fibers are mixed together. And the anaerobic fibers, which are the fast twitch, also called white, they're white because they're void of circulation. And they depend on the aerobic muscle to bring in blood flow and nutrients, including oxygen, and take out waste products. But basically, as we train with a submax heart rate, with that MAF heart rate, we get faster and faster. And the proportion between our submax pace and our race pace is something important to look at. So we can, on any given day, we could run fast. And in a 10K, for example, we could run at a certain percentage faster than our submax pace. Well, if we increase our submax pace, what happens to our max pace? It gets faster too. And for some reason, we have this idea that, you know, our fast twitch muscle fibers are going to atrophy. You can go down the street and pick a whole bunch of inactive people. You know, if you yell fire, they will start sprinting. How can they sprint? They haven't trained to sprint. They probably haven't sprinted in 50 years. How could they sprint? It's because we have this built-in mechanism beginning in our brain, the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic part. We have these muscle fibers at the other end that are fast twitch muscle fibers, and they're always on alert. This is our alert system. Our alert system is always ready to get out of the way, always ready to run, always ready to fight. It's the fight flight mechanism that we hear about. And that mechanism is always there. Sure, we can develop it in training even more, but it's always there. So if you train at a submax level for 6 months and don't ever race, the first thing you're going to say is, well, wait a minute, how am I going to know how to run fast? You have a brain. That's how you know. Your brain knows. So that's how you could run a PR after 6 months of training slow.
So this is all about a philosophy which basically infers that a rising tide lifts all boats. You're pushing everything up from underneath, whereas the other philosophy, which is like a crane lifting everything from above, which is limited anyway in the amount of training you can do because of fatigue and recovery.
Good analogy.
So the rising tide lifts all boats is the thing that we must think of. But I know some people also say, well, what about lactic acid clearance? When I'm running hard and I'm in a 10K and I'm going at this intensity, I've got lactic acid. So if I train my muscles to clear the lactic acid more effectively, I'll be able to cope with that better during a race. Is that wrong also, or is there a place for some specific threshold, black hole, no man's land type training at all in this approach? Or do we just forget about that?
Well, I think first of all, I'm very much in favor of high intensity training. I just wrote a chapter for a book called High Intensity Interval Training. So I'm not opposed to that. The problem is that if you're just starting out as an endurance athlete and you're beginning with track workouts, that's just dumb. It's called a base. You know, we need a foundation in which to build our performance, build our training on. So the first step is to build your aerobic system. And if you have a good aerobic system, now you're much more immune to getting injured. You're going to recover from any workout you do. You're going to recover from a race much better. You're going to have a longer, you're going to be able to race more. You're going to have a longer athletic life. Your illness is going to be less. I mean, just the benefits from aerobic, from a good aerobic system are just phenomenal. So it's the first thing we want to develop. And it takes 3, 4, 5, 6 months to develop a good aerobic system. And during that time, you get faster and faster. So you know that you're developing a good aerobic system because you can measure it and you feel better too. But from an objective standpoint, you can say, okay, and you could do this on a track or with today's GPS monitors. If you have a typical run you do, if it's not too hilly, it's a more objective measure. But you could see that, you know, oh, gee, when I get to the turnaround, I'm usually at this many minutes. Now I'm getting here a lot sooner at the same heart rate. Or you go to the track and you say, I could do, you know, I do 5 1-mile splits, and my first mile was 9 minutes. Now it's a month later, and I see that I'm now able to run 8.5 minutes for that same first mile. Then you know you're building your aerobic system, and then you know you're going to be a better racer as well. And then once you build that aerobic system, now you could add speed. You can add other, high intensity workouts, depending on you know who you are, what your goals are, and go from there. And then keep monitoring yourself, because that MAF heart rate, that pace you're able to run at, is such a good number. Because if you start getting slower, that should be a huge red flag. Why would you get slower? Why would an athlete suddenly get slower during training? You know, okay, maybe they had a bad day, but what if they're slower week by week? They just keep getting slower. It means they're overtraining, and it's the earliest stage, the earliest sign of overtraining. And most people wait until they can't get out of bed. They're so exhausted. So find out sooner that you're going the wrong way and say, hey, what am I doing different? Oh, I'm doing 3 track sessions a week because that's what my friends do. And so I'm going to do that too. Well, your body is saying, hey, this is not working. So it's a great, you know, talk about monitoring the body. It's a great tool.
I just wrote down a few things that you mentioned there, which I know that endurance athletes aren't particularly good at, because they all think that because they can do Ironman, they're indestructible. And so the normal rules of human health and physiology don't necessarily apply to them. But this thing, everybody talks about having a base, but it goes much deeper than that. It's like, you know, the bigger the foundation, the bigger the building you want to construct, the bigger the foundations have to be in order to support it over the long term. You'll see, Phil, that I quite like analogies. So, but you talk about monitoring rather than just letting stuff happen. You talk about health, and I know this from myself, that if you're ill, there's something wrong with your body. And if you're
there
ill,
is, and it's so sad that we still have this obsession that, you know, here, I'm an athlete, I'm tough, and if I get injured, then I'm going to train injured, because, you know, we hear it on TV during sports broadcasts. We have little kids listening to the announcer say, "Here's Big Joe, he's all taped up, he plays hurt."
Yeah,
and the kid thinks, number one, I'm going to play hurt. And number two, I want to get some tape on me because it's cool. Hey, can you put some tape on my knee? You know, and it's not the physical injuries that are the only problem, but there's the illness, the sickness that people come down with. Mm. And not only that, but we have people dropping dead of a heart attack in the middle of a race. I mean, come on. And nobody wants to talk about that. It's really, really sad. And it's a social phenomenon. It's not limited to sports. We see the same thing on Wall Street. We see the same thing in academia. We have this no pain, no gain attitude about life.
Mm.
and we need to snap out of it.
I see one of the problems with a lot of endurance sports, and triathlon's no different, that there's a lot of militaristic approach coming into it, you know, HTFU and man up and, you know, death before disappointment and all of that stuff. And yeah, if you're in the special forces and you're going into battle and there's a guy shooting at you and you have to get taped up to drag yourself out of that arena, otherwise the option is death, then sure, you have to man up because it's life or death. But there aren't many triathletes that I've met who go to start a race thinking they may not come back from this thing because somebody's going to shoot at them. It's not life or death, but yet we treat it as such. And I, like you, look at it through very sad eyes sometimes, that what we start off by doing that is maybe to lose some weight or to be active with our kids or to help us lead a healthier life, then becomes more destructive than what we weren't doing in the first place. And it is very, very sad.
Yeah, I've more than once I've said to an athlete after doing a good history, you should have remained as a couch potato. You would have been a lot healthier.
That's amazing. So let's just dive into this a bit more. So I think we've got around to the fact that you can do some intervals there, and that short, high intensity intervals. What you're almost suggesting here is a polarized approach to training, as it's become commonly and popularly known recently. Keep it really low the majority of the time, and then when you're ready, do some high intensity stuff. But you don't need to do the intervals for that long, and you don't need to do that many of them to sort of tickle that top end. And in the main, leave out the bit in the middle. But maybe you'll probably end up in that way if you go to a race on a weekend anyway, wouldn't you? So that would be enough of a workout rather than having to do it.
That's an important point. I often hear after these athletes, after their base, and they run a race off of base having done no speed work, and they run really well, they run a PR or they run whatever, and they come back and say, hey, why do I even do speed work if I'm able to run a PR off my base? And the answer really is that you want to train the speed parts of your body a little bit, because you'll get a little bit, you won't get a lot, but you'll get a little bit more race performance out of that. But you bring up a good issue, because the race itself can serve as a speed workout. So if you enjoy racing, then why not race more often, use your race as a speed workout, and all the rest of your training then is strictly aerobic at your MAF heart rate. And that's I've seen athletes do that, and they just enjoy the sport. They enjoy themselves. They're more proud of their performances when they do that.
Well, you talk about that enjoyment, Phil. You talk about running gait earlier on as well, and observing that. I'm constantly getting told off by my other half. When I'm driving, I look at people running and I'm almost automatically drawn to their running gait, you know, their technique, the fact that they can't pick their feet up, they haven't got any good calf strength, their glutes aren't working, their posture's all wrong. But when I get to look at their faces, I very rarely see somebody who has a look of enjoyment on their face.
It's
always one of anguish and pain and discomfort. And
it's so sad. I have a real hard time with it. I want to just stop and take them home.
Yes.
this is another example of the social phenomenon I mentioned earlier. We there are famous books out there, The Loneliness of a Long Distance Runner. It's just a bunch of crap. If we're not having fun, stay home.
Okay, on that note then, we'll so look, let's dive into some, there's probably a lot of the listeners here, Phil, and you're quite well known across the pond there in the US. You are getting more traction over here, but still a lot of people won't won't have heard of you and perhaps find this approach of yours slightly alien and sort of maybe uncomfortable for them. So I have a few more questions, and then I'd like to see if you can help me just to build up a sort of a 5 or 10 step plan for those who are interested in integrating this into their run or their triathlon training. I know that often your method and approach, and particularly if we look at your website, there's an awful lot of information there about nutrition as well. And I've heard you speak quite strongly and in great depth about the effect of nutrition. And, you know, as we're talking holistically, you can't do all of this healthy living and training without having a good approach to nutrition either. Particularly, you talk about your methods are often linked with ketosis and a ketonic state of training or lower carb intake. So which do you prefer as a long-term approach for endurance athletes, lower carb or keto or something in between?
Well, I rarely recommend people go into ketosis unless they have some medical condition, which I've seen and I've done. But I've been recommending this approach from the beginning. I'd learned about this in school. I mean, this is not new for me. And the whole, you know, ketosis is something, nutritional ketosis is something that was used in medicine for more than 100 years. So it's nothing new, in the world of healthcare either. I don't recommend diets, period. I recommend that people figure out what is the best way for them to eat. And when I'm working with an athlete, I do that with them one-on-one. I help them figure that out. And there are various signs and symptoms that they could use. But basically, what eating style makes you feel the best, makes you less hungry, makes you have less body fat or not have excess body fat, and perform better. And it may sound like it's overwhelming to figure that out, but it's really not. If we look at, I wrote a case history that we published in a scientific journal, coaching journal, using Amanda Stevens, who's now retired, as an Ironman triathlete. And she came to see me and had, you know, she wanted another good year. She was 38 and we just went through this process that I just mentioned. You know, let's figure out what's best to, you know, what eating plan is best for me. And when you do that, the first thing you do is you look at carbohydrates because they impact on our physiology immediately when we eat them. So that's a good place to start. And as you reduce your carbohydrates, you have to increase your fat and protein if you're not eating enough protein. And as soon as people hear that, they start to panic. What do you mean? I'm going to increase my fat? Well, we can get twice as much energy from fat as we can from carbohydrates. So think about that for a moment. The problem is people are not good fat burners. And one of the things that training the aerobic system does, one of the things that training at that MAF heart rate does, is it forces your physiology to become a better fat burner. And that's what you can measure in the lab. And as you become a better fat burner, you now have more energy available. You have so much more potential energy than from fat than from your glycogen stores. What a deal that is. With Amanda and in this study, and there's a, you can find that on my website. We basically said, look, you know, you've got these, you know, you've got hunger, your blood sugar tests are not good. Number one, let's reduce refined carbohydrates. You know, people think there's all this confusion about nutrition. There's two cuisines in the world. There's natural food and there's junk food. There's a consensus by all the science, unless you're working for a junk food company, all the scientists agree that we shouldn't be eating junk food. All the clinicians agree, except for the ones who are obese, that we shouldn't be eating junk food. So the first thing we do is get rid of the junk food. And junk food is, you know, refined carbohydrates, processed bagels, cereals, you know, the things that people like to eat, especially athletes, because they think that's where our energy comes from. And so once you've done that, you've got to put, like I said, you've got to put back the calories you took away. Otherwise, you're going to go into a calorie deficit, which you don't want to do. And then see how you feel.
Can I just ask you there, Phil? Sure. So you talk about getting rid of junk food and the things that you enjoy. So I quite like to have a bagel every now and then, or I like to have a bar of Dairy Milk chocolate, or, you know, sometimes when I'm out on a ride with my friends, I like to have a piece of cake. Now, I know full well that I'm not going to drop down dead immediately. It's not poisonous, so it's not immediately harmful for me. Are you an all or nothing when it comes to junk food, or are you happy with the occasional treat or cheat day?
Well, there's two things. One is there's no such thing in moderation when it comes to junk food, when it comes to refined carbohydrates, when it comes to sugar. That's like a heroin addict saying, all right, I'm not going to do heroin during the week. I'm only going to do it Friday and Saturday. Is that okay? Well, no, it's not okay. The other thing is that when you're out there on a long ride or when you're in a race, you want to have a carbohydrate drink, or you want to have a bar, or you want to have a gel. That's important. But you don't want to have those gels for lunch. You don't want to have those bars for snacks. You don't want to have a big glass of some sugar drink before you work out, because that is unhealthy. There's no question about that. And the fact that people are addicted to it doesn't change anything other than, okay, it's going to take a couple of days to, you know, go through your withdrawal from cookies. But, you know, it's not just the cookies and the cake. But if you start reading ingredients, you see that there's sugar in almost all packaged foods. You can't even go to buy to go to the store and buy cold cuts. You know, you want to buy some ham because you're going to have ham and eggs in the morning. You look at the ingredients and you see all the sugar in it. So the amount of sugar that athletes are consuming is terribly unhealthy. The best thing to do is to eliminate as much as possible. There's plenty of healthy stuff, fruit and, lentils and beans. There's plenty of healthy carbohydrates out there that you can consume.
Well, I'm looking on your website now, Phil, at your dessert category. There's some lovely creamy avocado pudding, picandy, Phil's bar, and Phil's fudge. I'm going to give those a try before I get my next Snickers from the store. Going down one of those rabbit holes I suggested we might be in, I think we should keep it short because we could never come out the other end. But we talk about this tendency of endurance athletes to think that they can eat sweet foods and sugary foods and, you know, cakes and biscuits because of all the training they're doing. Do you think we're storing up a major health problem that's going to appear among endurance athletes in the very near future, people who are being diagnosed as pre-diabetic despite training 10 or 15 hours a week?
Oh, we're way past that. We're already there.
Oh,
we're,
really?
We're seeing it. I had my clinic until about 1997. And long before I left, I closed down my clinic, I was seeing that. And when pre-diabetes became an official, quote-unquote, an official condition, you know, a lot of us clinicians were so relieved because we were seeing people who were not healthy, but they were not diagnosed as diabetic yet. But we watched a lot of them become diagnosed as diabetic. So we're seeing that. And I'll tell you where you see it. And it becomes obvious. You see it in increased body fat. Because when we eat refined carbohydrates, we produce more insulin, most people, more insulin than if we eat a natural carbohydrate. And that excess amount of insulin that we produce converts more of that carbohydrate, about 50% sometimes, to stored fat. People think, well, I'm going to have, you know, a low fat, I'm going to have a bagel, I'm not going to put cream cheese on it because I don't want the fat. Well, half that bagel turns to fat. You don't know which half, but half of it turns to fat. And and so with that bit of physiology in perspective, you need to say, okay, so if I keep making too much insulin, I'm going to store more and more fat. Not only is that going to happen, but now that insulin prevents you from taking the fat out of storage and using it for ATP production. So now your energy is limited because you can't get it. You can't get as much energy from stored fat. So therefore, you have to use more glycogen. And that's a recipe for disaster, obviously.
So that would account for the number of athletes that you see at marathons and at ultra endurance races, of which I'd class triathlon within that, who are seemingly doing 10, 15 hours a week, way more than the medical profession suggests is necessary for us to keep fit and healthy, and yet still carrying too much body fat and wondering why. That's basically the answer, isn't it? Is that
that is the answer, yes. You know, what they're thinking is, yeah, I'm training 15 hours a week. What they're saying is, I'm out there every day, I'm burning a lot of calories. And if you say to them, calories of what? Now they're confused. Mm. You know, what's this guy? Who is this guy? Is this a trick question? Who's this guy telling me, you know, calories of what? The problem is they're not burning calories of fat. Otherwise, they wouldn't have all that stored fat. So, yes, and you can see it at races. And I saw it a little bit in the 70s. I saw it a lot more in the 80s. And by, I think the first time it really hit me was at the Olympics in Seoul, Korea, in 1988. I was there and I saw some athletes who should not have had a lot of body fat have too much body fat, especially in the abdomen. And I realized that if I went to a marathon, a lot of times I'd go to marathons with professional runners and I wouldn't mingle with a lot of the amateur athletes. You know, I'd hang out with the professionals because that's why I was there. And I felt, but if you start looking around, if you hang out after the pros have come through and you start seeing the amateurs coming through, you start seeing a lot of people who are literally over fat, technically over fat, measurably over fat. And it's gotten worse and worse as the years have gone by, and it has corresponded with the overfat epidemic in the general population. It has corresponded with injury rates, and it has corresponded with diminishing performance times in the running community. And there's some very, very good data on that. So there's no question about it, and we know why a runner, for example, who has too much body fat would perform slower. So there's no, you know, and we certainly know why, or we certainly know what happens to a person, athlete or not, when there's too much body fat. Excess body fat is the first stage of chronic disease. So, you know, the trickle-down effects of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, et cetera, begins with excess body fat.
Well, it's interesting also to me that you talk about increasing injury rates. We know that a lot of endurance athletes pick up injuries. I'd always assumed it was just too much training, but there is a link between the inflammation that's caused by processed foods and the inability of muscle fibers to recover and that injury rate as well, isn't there?
You hit the nail on the head. Chronic inflammation is a first stage of injury, and chronic inflammation has already developed if you have too much body fat. So the, you know, and they call these things itis conditions. Itis at the end of the word, so tendonitis means inflamed tendon. Itis or inflammation is also the stage before measurable disease, and so it's all very organized. You know, our body is, you know, doesn't do things randomly. There is a process, and we can today we could measure these things quite well. And another problem with sugar, in addition to having so much of it turn to stored body fat and preventing body fat from being used as an energy source is that sugar directly produces inflammatory chemicals. So you're right. That's a very serious problem.
So basically, folks, that message there from Dr. Maffetone is natural food versus junk food. Just don't eat it. There is no one best method for nutrition. Just find the path that makes you perform better and helps you become a healthier athlete. And it's black and white, that one, natural food versus junk food, I think, almost.
Pretty, you know, every animal on earth knows how to eat except for humans.
And where do you stand on the on alcohol there, Phil? Do you class a glass of red wine as junk food, or because of some of its health properties, could you class it as medicinal?
I look at it as medicinal. I just wrote, I've written about alcohol for years, and I just wrote a new article on alcohol. And my recommendation was to stay below moderation. It had been to stay at moderation. Moderation is one drink for women, two for men, because men have bigger livers. My recommendation now is to stay at one drink a day or less if you're vulnerable. There are certain conditions that should say to you, you don't want to consume alcohol at all, because it then has an adverse effect on health.
Whew, I'm glad then. At least I can, now that I've given up chocolate and cakes and biscuits, at least I can enjoy a glass of wine every evening.
Well, you don't have to give up chocolate. So you saw the recipe. So there's a healthy way to make that stuff. And I've been eating this way forever, and I don't deny myself. I enjoy every meal I eat. I enjoy preparing food. I enjoy the real cocoa. I enjoy it all.
Fantastic. Right. So I've got a couple more questions for you, Phil. You and I both know that everyone's an individual. It's one of the basic tenets of fitness is that, you know, something that works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for another because of their own individual circumstances, physiology, age, gender, et cetera, et cetera. So my next question is, the MAF method of training, is that going to work for everybody, or are there certain people that it may not work for, or is it just that there are just going to be a range of different responses from people? Some are going to be super responders and some aren't going to respond very well, but they will respond.
If you're human, you'll respond, or if you're a horse, you will respond, because I've worked with horses. The difference is that some people will respond better than others, and the reason they respond better is because their lifestyle is healthy. So if you want to respond, if you want to be the best athlete you can, then have a healthy lifestyle and monitor your health. The MAF approach is really an approach to being healthy and fit. So it's not a technique. It's a philosophy in that it's an approach to being healthy and fit. There's no, you know, you can't do this, you have to do that kind of stuff. You do have to build an aerobic system because that's natural. A lot of that kind of stuff is because we're in a society where people are not able to use their intuition. And I've not found many athletes who could do that. When I worked with Greta Weitz, the first time I put a heart monitor on her and I said, here's where I want you to run at this heart rate. And I'm running around the track with her and she says, I said, run the way you'd normally run every day. And she said, yeah, this is the pace I run at every day. And I looked down and it was exactly where I wanted her heart rate. That kind of intuition, that kind of instinctual training, we just don't see much. People are influenced by our training partners, our magazine articles, podcasts, TV. No Pain, No Gain society is where it comes from, and we can't get away from that everywhere we go. And it's really sad. So think individually, and what the heart monitor is really is a simple biofeedback device that will enable you to read your body a lot easier.
I'm just going to absorb all of that now. Instinct, intuition. It's almost like we had a little thing last year asking people to race naked, and they did raise some eyebrows to start with, but when we explained it was just getting rid of the gadgets and just trying to listen to your body, and by all means take the heart rate monitor out with you and play a little game and see, have that preset level, it might be, you know, 180 minus your age, and then come back and see how close your instinct enabled you to get to what to the right zone. Most people got nowhere near it, but it was an interesting lesson. Okay, right, Phil, so here's what I've done. As we've been chatting, I've been making some notes, and I've come up with a step-by-step process, which I think that would be, if anybody wanted to try this, and it's coming towards the end of the triathlon season here in the UK, so once they've had an end-of-season break of a few weeks, it would be perfect for them to introduce this now when there's no stress. So if I can go along and give you my steps, and then you can correct me and add things in if I've got them wrong. Yeah? How does that sound?
Sure. Yep.
Okay. So number one, firstly, before you even start any training, make sure that you are healthy, that you've recovered, that you have no chronic injuries, no niggles, no pains, no nothing, so that you're in the best health position, ready to start your program. Would that be a good start?
It's a good start. Yeah. I mean, an injury means something's wrong. So you've got to figure out what's wrong.
I've listened to you chat before as well about when people are taking medication, and that indicates that, you know, that's one of the adjusters to your math formula, is if you're taking medication, you need to minus some more heartbeats to go a bit easier. So if you're on medication at any point, then that also is a sort of a target for before you begin your training, is to try and get off the medication, I would assume, if it's at all possible.
Yes. And you know, it's amazing how many people are taking medications today, even compared to 10 years ago. And when I was first in practice, there just weren't a lot of people on medication. And then suddenly, you know, they're coming in and they're now taking 5, 6, 7 different medications. I saw people taking 20 and 30 medications. So the question is, does this person need to be on medication, or is there something they can do with their lifestyle that will eliminate the need for the medication? In the case of sugar, one of the concerns I have raised with people is that if they're on high blood pressure medication, and if they're on other medication for cholesterol or triglycerides, but especially with blood pressure medication, giving up sugar will normalize blood pressure in most people. And if you do that, you give up sugar, and you bring your blood pressure down, and now you're still on medication, you risk having abnormally low blood pressure, which is very dangerous. So you've got to be careful with that. And also, you know, giving up sugar can do something very interesting to women of childbearing age. It can balance their hormones, and it makes them more fertile. And I learned about this from a patient who came in because she was overweight, and I got her off sugar, and she came in about 3-4 months later and announced that she was pregnant. And I said, well, I don't have anything to do with it. And she said, well, my husband and I have been trying for 15 years. We've been to all the clinics, blah, blah, blah. And then she sent some other people in who had fertility problems, and they became pregnant. And I realized that, you know, what we were doing was improving their balance of hormones, and fertility was restored. And it became actually a very successful fertility treatment. You know, we're dealing with physiology here, and the effects can be profound. So, when you start looking at making these changes, you've got to look at getting healthy. And if you see something that's not right, whether you're on medication or you're injured, you've got to address that problem.
Okay. So not only will being healthy, injury-free, and no medication be good for you to start your training if you're looking to give birth, that's a good start point too. Who knew that this triathlon podcast would be so wide-reaching?
Well, it's one big – it's all – don't get me started.
Well, it is. Yeah, I get you. Okay, so the next point, before we even start thinking about training, I think there's a mindset approach here, to be patient, to be happy to slow down in the short term. So you basically, you've got to take that ego and you've got to lock it away somewhere, because if you're swimming with a group of guys or you're running with them on the track, initially you're going to have to be happy to be running slower and training easier than they are. And that's very difficult. So this method of training, if you can't control that ego, this method of training is actually going to be very difficult for you to take on board.
Without a doubt. It's built into the sports society, no pain, no gain. And it's unfortunate, and it makes it difficult for a team sport. You know, if you're on a soccer team and everybody gets together at, 8 a.m. to work out, and you want to run 5 laps or whatever, you can't do it all together, which is okay, because you're going to all do it for the same amount of time about. So if half the people are on the other side of the field, get over it.
Well, I guess I used to work in a team sport as a fitness coach, and that was always the most difficult thing, was coming from a triathlon coaching background and working with the individual, was to then apply this blanket team approach, when really you should have been just, when you've got 20 individuals, instead of one program for 20, you should have had 20 individual programs.
Exactly.
That was always a difficult concept to get across to the coach. Yep. Okay. So the next thing, before we've even started training, is perhaps the stress of adjusting your nutrition will be too much if you do it at the same time as starting a new training methodology. So perhaps before you start there, you'll actually make some gains in your health and fitness if you remove all of that junk food.
Yeah, you could do that today. You could do that as soon as you listen to this podcast.
I'm on it already, Phil. I'm on it already, Phil. There was some chocolate there, but I put that in the bin, just so you know.
Good. Well, nutrition is a very complex subject. The biochemistry, there's just so much there, and people get confused when they start hearing a discussion or recommendations, or they start reading a book about. And my approach is, hey, listen, I want you to do one thing. I'm making one recommendation. All you have to do is one thing. Don't eat any more sugar. How easy can that be conceptually? How easy can that be? And it's not just the white stuff that they put in food, but it's the refined flour that when you eat quickly turns to sugar. So having a bagel is like having, a couple of teaspoons of straight sugar that you just eat.
Okay. Removing the junk food then. Start today on that one. You can do that. And that's something that you could do in your end of season recovery. You could be doing all of these things to get ready. That's end of season recovery doesn't just mean reducing your training. It also means preparing your body for the next stage. So if it means taking care of all those injuries, going to see your physio to get a musculoskeletal assessment and find out where you can improve, where you might have some injury hotspots, removing the junk food, focusing on getting more sleep and laying down some good habits, so that by the time you get to the start of your training again, you've been at them for 6 weeks, and then adding the training on top of that is so much easier. So,
yeah, and just to emphasize, monitor your progress. So
yeah,
if you're going out and you've got your monitor and you've got your new training heart rate and you're slow, it doesn't matter. What's going to happen in 2 weeks? Well, you should be noticeably faster in a couple of weeks. You should be even more noticeably faster a month later. And the thing is, if you're not, something is wrong. Maybe you're sneaking in too much sugar. Maybe you're, something's not right. So physical, biochemical, and mental, emotional stress will impair aerobic development. So something is blocking your natural ability to get faster as a human being. And you got to figure out what that is. And maybe you find a coach or a physio or a clinician who can do some blood tests or whatever. And you get rid of those roadblocks, and all of a sudden you will progress.
Cool. Right then, folks. So you've done all of that prep work. Now we're going to talk about training a bit. So the first thing you need to do in order to monitor your progress is to test your pace, your effort at the MAF heart rate. So it's 180 minus age. In the show notes, I will make a link to the page on Phil's website where he goes into detail on this. So I'm not going to reinvent the wheel here. There are also some guidelines there for these plus and minus figures we've talked about. So I think one of them is if you've trained for the last year without interruption or injury or serious illness, that you can add 5 onto there, meaning you can go a little bit harder. If you're on medication, as we discussed, you may have to reduce, or you've had a significant illness or injury or period out, you may have to reduce that heart rate by 5 or 10. But you need to come up with a figure that is 180 minus your age and then plus or minus a few numbers to get your operating heart rate for this test. And then you're going to go out, and if it's running, you're going to run for maybe 30 minutes or maybe a set distance, making sure that your heart rate doesn't go above that level. That's it. It's a big line. You're not supposed to go above that level. So if it gets too high, you're going to have to walk. And when you get back, you need to record how long you've run for that distance, or how far you covered in that time. And that is your benchmark, by which Phil refers to there as monitoring your progress over the next few weeks. Have I got that bit right, Phil?
Perfect. Yep. Okay. Yep. And you can do it. You can go to the track and do it, you know, measure miles or kilometers. You can do it with a GPS on your normal, relatively flat training run. You can do it on your bike. You can do it. You can count laps in the pool.
Now this, can I just interrupt you there then? Because that is a question. The heart rate monitors aren't as good at picking up the heart rate and limiting that. So you could finish with your heart rate below the MAF agreed level, but it may have strayed above that during the test. So how do we monitor effort in the pool?
It requires a little bit of practice. You do one lap and you look at your heart rate.
Okay.
And at some point you know, I used to joke with people, although I've won a lot of good bottles of wine. But I would say, hey, you know, you'll know what it feels like to run at 140 or 150 or 130. I could run at any pace you tell me to run. I'll run, and here, you hold my watch, and I'll run at 146 heart rate. I'll bet you a bottle of wine. And sure enough, I had run for so many years looking at my heart rate that I knew what it felt like to be at 146. I knew what 130 felt like. It's not that hard to do. It's that intuition. It's that instincts. It's, we need to feel our bodies better. We're so used to numbing ourselves with no pain, no gain, not to mention numbing ourselves with medication. We need to feel our bodies. And that's why I don't, with all due respect, I don't want people listening to a podcast or listening to my music when they're training. I want them to listen to their bodies. Because
music to my ears. Excuse the pun.
That's where it's at. Your brain knows what you should be doing. And if you just get your emotions out of the way, things will fall into place a whole lot better. So the use of a heart monitor is really a transition to that state. And that's what biofeedback is, basically.
It always makes me chuckle with the irony of athletes who say that they're training with a specific target. Then when you ask them why they're wearing earbuds and listening to a podcast, say, oh, well, it just takes my mind off the training. Like, well, how's that going to be doing any good then? You know, when we talk about, I know when people talk about junk mileage, they usually talk about running at MAF pace because they don't think it's got any benefit. But for me, junk mileage isn't, if it's a specific reason why you're doing that, then that's, and you're entirely focused on that act of training and your breathing and your relaxation and your gait for 60 minutes, then that's quality training. The junk training comes when you can't remember from minute one to minute 60 what you've actually done. That's where it's junk, because it's
point. I didn't know they were using that term anymore, junk miles.
Oh, well, people do all the time. I don't, you know, when I'm riding to work, it's junk miles. Well, if you actually ride to work with a specific heart rate in mind and a specific cadence, and you can think about every single thing you do, how you hold the handlebars, how you're relaxed, how deep you're breathing, whether it's belly breathing or, you know, chest breathing, and you can get to work in 30 minutes having focused on all those things, that's quality. If you don't,
sure is.
Okay, back to the step process then. So Just to summarize, so we've got get healthy, injury free, and no medication first. Be patient and happy to slow down by shutting away the ego. Remove all junk food. So that's the one step that Phil's mentioned today. Start immediately. Ditch the sugar. Monitor your progress, not just with your training, but with your health and everything, your sleep and your recovery, and learn to listen to what your body's saying.
Just a quick aside, going back to the medication. Don't just stop your medication. Talk to your doctor.
Yes.
Talk to who prescribed it. That's the legal way to do it. And if they don't want to help you, find somebody else who can help you.
Okay. I mean, it's I don't know a lot about the medical profession in this country, Phil. There will be some subtle differences, I think, in prescription and everything. But certainly, if somebody's prescribed you drugs, then you're best off talking to the person who's prescribed it first before you make changes. Don't just go about that your own way. We talked earlier, Phil, about speed work, but we don't want people to introduce that. We need them to have been working at this 180 minus age heart rate for what, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months before they start introducing any high intensity intervals?
I like at least 3 months of an aerobic base. And during that time, you should see some significant speed increases at your pace at the same MAF heart rate. Now, a lot of people, when they get there, they say, well, gee, I want to keep getting faster at the same heart rate. Well, then build 6 months of base and you'll just get faster. The more base you build, the better an endurance athlete you'll become, and the healthier you'll be, and the more body fat you'll lose.
And that's it, really, isn't it? That is the simple thing. It's not complicated. It's be consistent. So we're almost talking, I'll go back to my analogies now, but we're almost talking about the tortoise versus the hare. And I've drawn a graph here with the X and Y axis and a line just going straight out of there upwards. Nice, steady progress. And then around it, I've drawn something that looks like a spider's run around my graph with your average triathlete's progress, where they go vertical for a bit and then they get injured, so they go backwards, then they go round and round in circles for a bit, and then they make amazing progress again. But ultimately, the hare, having run himself ragged, is way behind the tortoise, who's just made steady progress by doing the same thing and monitoring his progress.
You got it. That's great.
Oh, folks, this has been an amazing call. Miss Dr. Phil Maffetone, I keep forgetting that, Dr. Phil Maffetone has shared some amazing insights into life, into philosophy, into education, into medicine, into fitness, all of which are wrapped up together. They're not exclusive of each other. They're all wrapped up into that thing we have in our heads called the human brain, and the thing that's supporting it, which is called the body. And if you want to get the most out of it, you start by doing the simple things. Look after it. Reasonable amounts of exercise, get some sleep, and understand the messages it's giving you. Have I interpreted all that correct, Dr. Phil?
You've done a great job, Simon. That's I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, well, I think that's probably a good note to end here, Phil. Now, I know that I'm going to get an awful lot of questions about this, so I'm hoping that you might agree to come back and be a guest on the show when it's convenient for you, in maybe a couple of months' time, if that's okay.
I'd be happy to. This was fun.
Great. Well, I've enjoyed myself as well. So thanks so much for being on the show, Phil. Really, really appreciated that. Listeners, as I always say, I know that there are a lot of health and triathlon podcasts out there for you to choose from. So I really am very, very grateful every week that you choose to come and listen to this one. I hope you've enjoyed it. I have. We've been on for nearly an hour and a half. And I promise you in the beginning that these podcasts are only 30 minutes long. So I hope you won't hold it against me too much, because it's been full of some amazing conversation. So from me, just to say thank you for being here. I will have more awesome guests in the future. But from myself and Dr. Phil Maffetone, thank you for listening. That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. you could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.